Part 2. Revelator. Chapter 7. Six sleeping bodies fell towards Mars. Their re-entry capsule had detached from its mother vessel just beyond the boundary of the interdiction volume. 19 decoys of similar size and mass had also been deployed, hoping to confuse and overwhelm our orbital defense systems and allow the occupied defection capsule to slip through the screen and make it down to the surface. It was a familiar strategy. We were ready for it. In the 9 months since the war's outbreak, we had engaged with countless similar efforts, originating from all over the system. It would have been simpler to shoot at the mother vessels before they reached the interdiction boundary, but we had foolishly agreed to some military treaties that made such actions problematic. Often, the incoming ships contained human shields, civilian hostages who were not fully turned to the conjoiner ideology. It was not good for our cause to be seen to be killing too many civilians, so we were obliged to track these ships, but not to fire on them unless they made a clear bid for the surface. Any re-entry capsules were considered fair game, but only once they had crossed the interdiction boundary, which was just wide enough to include the orbit of Deimos, the outermost of the two tiny Martian moons. The orbital tracking systems and gun platforms had to operate smoothly to target these defection capsules, and lately they had been getting a lot of practice. Our interception efficiency was now at 96%, meaning that fewer than 1 in 20 attempts to reach the surface succeeded. The enemy knew that as well. It was why they had begun to make increasing use of decoys. In response, we deployed more guns and improved our discrimination algorithms. Against such measures, this new capsule stood little chance. As it fell into their sphere, the tracking systems had shone lasers onto each of the 20 possible targets. The lasers' photons had been reflected off the hulls and reacquired. By measuring phase shifts between the transmitted and reflected light, tiny vibrations in the interiors of the capsules could be detected. A particular pattern of signals was only coming from one of the capsules. Fourier analysis showed that this pattern was consistent with 6 human heartbeats. The guns were assigned and prioritized accordingly, concentrating their attention on that one capsule while neglecting none of the other 19. It was a given that at some point the conjoiners would find a way of confusing the heartbeat detectors. The guns fired, spitting out high-velocity railgun shells. There was no immediate kill. The capsules swerved and veered in a way that made course prediction difficult. We had beam weapons, more powerful versions of the detection lasers, but these were cumbersome to deploy, slow to energize, and not as quick to achieve a kill as a single well-aimed shell. Ultimately, force of numbers was still on our side. With multiple guns spaced around Mars at different inclinations and elevations, a number of different course predictions could be fed into the targeting systems at the same time. Sooner or later, 19 times out of 20, one gun was going to make the correct shot. One after the other, most of the 19 decoys were taken care of. One shell each was all it took in most cases. 3 probable decoys got through to the upper atmosphere, but subsequent tracking showed that none of them made any attempt to slow down before cratering into the surface at multiple kilometers per second. That left the 20th, the one with the heartbeats. Luck was on its side for a while. There were 3 distinct intervals, each lasting several seconds, when one or more guns had ample opportunity to shoot down the capsule. The guns swung and their magnetic barrels cycled to firing readiness. But the guns did not discharge. Treaty compliance systems had activated, putting the guns into temporary safing conditions. Areas of the Martian surface remained under Demarchist jurisdiction, even if they had been all but abandoned, and the guns were forbidden from firing if their projected lines of fire transgressed any of those sensitive areas. That still left one gun that had a clear shot at the capsule. The gun was in the lowest orbit of any of the weapons, and its position meant that it had to fire up and away from Mars, not down at it. Even if the shell missed the target, or sailed right through, it would just become another piece of fast-moving deep space debris on its way out of the solar system. Since there were no treaty entanglements, the gun was free to operate. It cycled up to firing readiness, a shell already chambered and dialed to its maximum impact yield. The gun was extremely confident of doing the job it asked of itself. It had 15 whole milliseconds in which to fire. Inside the defection capsule, the hearts of the sleepers each gave off a single beat. The gun detected a fault. It was a malfunction alert, an error diagnostic that had floated up through its decision action modules without any prior warning. Puzzled, the gun put itself into a temporary safing mode while it conducted a thorough top-down systems review. The safing mode was scheduled for 3 milliseconds, undesirably long but sufficient, the gun felt, to resolve the problem and continue with the firing sequence. The gun needed to know exactly where it was pointed. This was not normally a problem, since the gun maintained a history of itself and was in constant dialogue with the other weapons, platforms, and tracking systems, enabling a continuous process of error correction. Until that alert, the gun had never had any cause to doubt its faculties. Yet now, one of its 3 extremely precise helium superfluid gyroscopes was giving a discrepant reading. As far as the gun was concerned, the 2 majority readings were the ones to be trusted, especially as they were self-consistent with its assumed orientation, as well as the verifying signals it had received as part of the last error correction pulse. But still, there was a small but finite chance that the minority reading was correct, and too much was at stake for the gun to be able to dismiss that possibility. It would not be the one to break the treaty conditions. The gun needed more time to get to the bottom of this. It extended its safing mode by another 3 milliseconds while it ran more detailed functional checks on the gyroscopes. It was now more than 6 milliseconds into its firing window. There was still time. The functional checks were inconclusive. There might have been a hint of a developing failure mode in the suspect gyroscope 22 seconds earlier, but the statistics were far too poor to rely on. The gun dithered, using up more of its available firing window. Nothing in its history had prepared it for this. Less than 3 milliseconds now remained. In 2 milliseconds, the next error correction update was due to arrive from the rest of the network. Could it wait that long? The gun thought ahead, simulating the time it would need to analyze that update and make a decision concerning the gyroscope discrepancy. The time was insufficient. The gun could arrive at a decision, but there would not be enough of the window remaining to launch the shell. The gun reanalyzed its simulation, seeking a way to streamline the process. If it emptied some arrays and made reasonable guesses about the likely contents of others and was prepared to proceed on the basis of an incomplete but reasonably robust analysis of the error correction pulse. But no, it could not be done, not under any circumstances. All pathways that involved a firing solution within the window involved at least as much of a gamble as simply firing now, without waiting for the update. The gun could not act. It held itself in safing mode, and the window closed. The 6 sleepers remained silent. There had not been time for any one of their hearts to beat again. By the time one of them did, the capsule had passed out of range of the interdiction's guns, already feeling the first thin, cold kiss of Martian atmosphere. Beneath it lay the desolate, time-blasted uplands of the Tharsis Bulge. The opening of the casket's petals jolted me into consciousness. Glass and her robots had put me into it, but now I seemed to be expected to get out on my own. It was tempting to do nothing except wallow in my slowly returning sense of self. Getting out of the casket at all felt like a form of treasonous cooperation. But at the same time, I did not want to die. The ship sounded quiet. I raised an arm, allowed it to float in front of my face. Scythe was weightless, which could only mean that it was not under any form of acceleration. I eased myself out of the casket, floating free. I rubbed my limbs, inspecting the damage. Whatever shunts, plugs, and monitoring devices it might have applied to me before I went under had detached painlessly, leaving only a few sore spots. There was no hint of tremor in my hands, and when I touched my fingertips, the old numbness had vanished. The casket must have rebuilt my peripheral nervous system while I was under. I pushed myself sideways, along to the adjoining casket. It was also open. "Glass?" I called out, as much to test my vocal cords as to summon my host. My voice was raw and dry, but more than ample to reach beyond the hibernaculum. "Glass, where are you?" No reply. I moved around the hibernaculum, drifting from one point to the next. It was easy, since I was never out of reach of a hand or foothold. The air was cool, and I was glad to find a cabinet that held a couple of extra layers I could wrap around myself. Another contained various medical and nutritional dispensers. I used them without hesitation. If Glass was going to poison me, then this was an absurdly long-winded way to go about it. Deciding that nothing was going to be gained by waiting in the hibernaculum, I set off to investigate. Provided the ship allowed me into the areas I had already seen, I fully expected to find Glass up and active, wearing an attitude of detached indifference to my feelings. But Glass was in none of the places I knew. The ship made no effort to obstruct or confuse me. For once, corridors led where I expected them to lead, doors were where they were meant to be, and all I found was empty rooms. Finally, one of the spheres appeared. It seemed to be on its way somewhere, limbs retracted into its body. I followed it all the way back to the belly airlock chamber, where I had first come aboard. There was still no sign of Glass, but one of the suits remained, partially submerged into the wall. Where the other had been was a hollow, suit-shaped concavity. "Scythe," I said, "if you can hear me and understand me, can you confirm that Glass has left the ship?" No answer. I went to the airlock, hoping there might be a clue as to when it had last been activated. But as with much of the ship, the readouts and controls were subjugated to neural or gestural channels to which only Glass had access. I had already searched the control room, but I went back there anyway. I had been looking for Glass before. Now I wanted to know what might be outside. Nothing had caught my eye before, and there was a reason for that. The windows were a ribbon of blackness. Scythe was not near a planet or a star, or in orbit around anything. But if we were in interstellar space, where were the stars? Even if we were mid-crossing, one or two of the brighter stars should have been visible, even allowing for relativistic effects. Glass had given me authority to learn the control system. Did that set of permissions still apply? I put it to the test, easing into the same acceleration chair I had used before. Sensing me, the readouts in my locus of the control room shifted to russish. This time, I concentrated. None of the configurations were familiar, but neither were any so alien that I could not make some hesitant sense of them. Some related to the direct control of the ship, its engines, precision maneuvering systems, and navigational functions. Even some hints that I might have limited access to defensive and offensive measures. 10 minutes later, I had learned nothing of the ship's status or position, but I had found a way to reduce the glow from the controls, as well as increasing the transmitted light through the false windows. It made almost no difference. If there were so few photons reaching Scythe's sensors, then there was only so much it could do to amplify them for my benefit. There were hints of fixed structure out there, little twinkling emanations coming from roughly the same handful of places, but nothing my eyes or brain could make sense of. If Scythe had landed inside one of the caverns on Sun Hollow, without the benefit of artificial lights, the view would have been barely distinguishable from what I was seeing. But the one thing I could be sure of was that we were not inside a planet, be it Charybdis or any other stopping point, or even any sort of moon or asteroid. By now, even a weak gravitational field would have revealed itself. I returned to the airlock. One suit was still present, and one still absent. I floated up to the one suit that was still there, facing the tinted band of its visor. There were no controls or seams on the outside. No clue as to how I was meant to get into the thing. "Open," I commanded. The suit did not obey. Then I remembered Glass telling me in the tunnel that all I needed to do was shuffle into my suit, or just allow it to come to me, submitting to the suit's programmed desire to shield me from vacuum. It was obvious in hindsight that the suit would be programmed to respond to a postural proximity trigger. I only had to avert myself from the suit while maintaining the same body orientation and drift slowly towards contact with it. The suit gave some wet, slurping sounds as it opened up along hidden bonds, and then extended parts of itself to wrap around and guide me in. I pushed aside any inclination to panic. If the suit was clever enough to detect my intention to wear it, then it surely knew better than to suffocate me. The suit came to life. Around the visor's field of view appeared the same pattern of symbols and readouts I had come to recognize during our exodus from Sun Hollow. The only difference was the suit's annotation had shifted to Russish. I was still ignorant about many of the suit's functions, but I knew the color green when I saw it. Where dials and needles were displayed, they were all comfortably into that end of the spectrum. The suit was powered up and stocked with all that it needed, and had presumably taken care of any repairs or maintenance needed after Sun Hollow. I had a feeling it could keep me alive for a very long time. I tried moving my arms. The suit complied with my request, alleviating much of the effort, but leaving just enough resistive feedback to remind me I was suited and at the mercy of its protection. Next, I tried propelling myself away from the recessed berth in the wall. The suit came unglued, then drifted. I put out my arms and legs and checked myself against the opposite wall. Then I turned around until I had the airlock in sight. It was one thing to get the suit working. I had already been allowed a degree of autonomy during our walk. But Glass would never have wanted me to be able to use one of the locks without her consent, in case I did something inconvenient, like killing myself. I used a combination of drifting and handholds to bring myself to the lock, but it would not open for me. I tried pressing my hand against the panel around the door, hoping to work some hidden control, but nothing obliged. I needed some assistance. "Can you understand me?" "Yes," the suit answered, speaking with a fast, buzzy intonation, like a recording that had been speeded up. "I need to leave Scythe. Open the airlock for me."
"Unit Beta cannot pass this request."
"There is a door ahead of me. I need you to make it open."
"Unit Beta cannot pass this request."
"Wait," I said, mentally backtracking. "Where is Unit Alpha?"
"Unit Alpha is extravehicular."
"Is Unit Alpha coming back?"
"Unit Beta cannot pass this request."
I could feel my breathing quicken. I hoped that the suit would be a little more helpful when I asked to be allowed out of it. "Tell me, how far away is Unit Alpha?" The suit seemed to think this over. I wondered if it was stupid or damaged, or laboring under such a restrictive set of command protocols that it could answer almost no request.
"Unit Alpha is 1.23 kilometers from Unit Beta."
"Is Unit Alpha on the move?"
"Unit Beta cannot—"
"Never mind," I interrupted. "Can Unit Beta open a communications channel to Unit Alpha?"
"An event log channel remains open."
"I want to speak to Glass. To the occupant of Unit Alpha. Can you make that happen?"
"Unit Beta cannot—"
"Never mind. Can Unit Beta follow Unit Alpha?"
"Unit—"
"And never mind that either. Take me to Unit Alpha." There was a pause.
"Verify directive?"
"Yes," I exclaimed, before the dim-witted suit lost the thin thread of comprehension it had finally established. "Verified."
"Directive accepted. Unit Beta will assume autonomous control until directive is satisfied. Autonomous control may be overridden at any point. Prepare for vehicle egress and transition to hard vacuum."
What had been impossible for me was simplicity for the suit, now that it had a purpose. The lock opened automatically and the suit drifted me into it. The lock cycled. The exchange was rapid and it could only have been 30 seconds before the outer door opened and the suit accelerated me out of Scythe into whatever volume of space surrounded the ship. I looked around. I had some lateral view through the visor, but if I averted my direction of gaze sufficiently, the symbols around the visor shuffled obligingly, and the visible field extended back another 10 or 15 degrees,
to the limit of my peripheral vision. If I carried on trying that, the suit created another visual band above the main one, displaying a rear-looking view and allowing my eyes to rest. Apart from the glowing belly lock, which was already sealing up after me, I could see nothing of Scythe against the blackness of its surroundings. I felt a faint, rising acceleration. The suit was gaining speed via its micro-thrusters. Glass had never used them, so I guess they were only powerful enough to function in a weightless vacuum. It was unnerving, like closing my eyes and running headlong into a darkened room, not knowing how far away the walls were. The airlock had closed completely, robbing me of a reference point. Within a few seconds, I had lost any sense of our speed or direction. "Slow down. Do you wish to amend the current directive?" "No. I don't want to crash into anything." The suit pondered my answer. "Collision mitigation measures are in force. Do you wish to review the collision mitigation measures?" "No, I... yes. Yes. Show me the measures." A list of items scrolled onto the upper left part of my visor. As soon as I saw it, I realized how much was going on without my direct awareness. The suit, not troubling me with what it considered to be matters of minor housekeeping. It was scanning the space around us with radar and laser-ranging systems of proven reliability. It was using image amplification to detect visual obstacles. It was running gravitational, proximal, space-time gradient measurements capable of detecting any large, dense, nearby object. It was sniffing for neutrinos, muons, and a dozen other particle types. It was even ingesting the not-quite-perfectly-hard vacuum and running mass spectroscopy on trace atoms and ions, and it was following the course log transmitted by Glass's suit when it made exactly the same journey. Now that I knew what the suit was up to, and satisfied that a collision was not my biggest concern, I persuaded the suit to show me a visual representation of its active and passive sensory modes. A lilac-tinted tracery settled over my field of view, annotated with rapidly changing digits, showing relative distance and velocity. Rough surfaced walls surrounded the whole space, which I now understood to be hundreds of meters across. It was a cavern, after all. Deeper than it was wide, and with sheer, circular ends, like a cylinder. Most of this three-dimensional contour map was assembled from radar and laser returns, but there were also several pale, glowing smudges that must have corresponded to the faint lights I had seen from inside Scythe. Only now did I understand that these smudges were caused by light leaking into the cavern from outside. The suit conveyed me towards the cavern's wall, heading towards a depression or rent in the wall's surface. Again, it seemed that we were going too fast, but the suit had matters under control. From somewhere in my chest, thrusters began to burn, quickly reducing our speed. As the wall approached, so the overlay became sharper, and with a jolt of shifting perceptions, I realized that what I had taken to be natural formations were nothing of the kind. The walls were of artificial construction, yet lacking any regularity or organization. There were interlocking panels, projecting modules, crisscrossing pipes and conduits, handling arms, claw-like docking cradles, all of it huge in scale, while at the same time appearing haphazard and piecemeal, as if a succession of owners had each their own ideas about repair and alteration. The chamber also bore the imprint of the melding plague, which is why I had been so easily convinced that the enclosure was natural. The plague's fibrous, branching strands had erupted across nearly every surface, softening and corrupting where it touched. It was like the cloisters of some abandoned cathedral, wreathed in pale, worming vines and slowly succumbing to ruin and time. The presence of the plague stirred the usual fears, hardly blunted after 30 years in Sun Hollow, but the corruptive process appeared to have been arrested here. The plague must have gained a hold, then faltered, leaving the chamber's original form still recognizable, and with no projection into the main volume. There might still be traces of active spore, but if I wished to pursue Glass, I would have to put such concerns aside. My quarry had come this way and must have known what her suit was capable of dealing with. The gap in the wall was just wide enough for me to pass through. The suit swiveled, reorientating me. The gap was a rupture, or what remained of a doorway, allowing entry into what I first took to be a corridor, running in the same direction as the chamber's longest axis. It was very wide to be a corridor, though, and despite the plague's predations, it was still possible to make out the linear tracks which threaded along its length, spaced around the walls at intervals of 90 degrees. Buckled and interrupted as they were, I recognized their function. Guidance rails for a vehicle, a train, or perhaps an elevator.
Minimum hazard threshold exceeded. Verify continuation of current directive?
Verify, I answered, but not without some disquiet. Still weightless, the suit drifted along this railed shaft. In the confined space, it was content to move at only a little more than walking pace, fearing now and then to avoid some jagged protrusion or crimpage that blocked a clear path. There was no danger of anything still moving along these ruined rails, but only the rational part of my brain understood that. I still kept glancing behind, using the rear-angle display. If I was not doing so at regular intervals, my neck prickled. By now I had narrowed down my ideas about our location to 3 possibilities. The first was a cylindrical space inside some small rocky body, say an asteroid a few kilometers across. That was how some habitats were arranged, with the rock providing radiation shielding and impact protection. The second was a minor variation on that, a thin-walled, artificial world in the form of a cylinder, but which, for some reason, was no longer spinning to generate artificial gravity. The third possibility, and the one I instinctively knew to be the correct solution, was that I was inside a starship. A light hugger, as large as Silence in Heaven, or our own Salmasis. Such vessels were easily big enough to contain 10 or 20 docking or cargo bays the size of this chamber. It fitted with what little I knew. Glass had spoken of business needing to be conducted before our next port of call, perhaps a rendezvous of some kind. I had never been meant to be awake for any part of that affair, but that assumed that Glass's plan went smoothly. How far away is Unit Alpha?
Unit Alpha is 0.243 kilometers from Unit Beta.
Less than a quarter of a kilometer. If there had been air, I could have called out to her. The shaft forked, a junction where the elevator was able to switch tracks. The suit took the less damaged of the two options, picking up speed again even as the shaft deflected, obstructing my direct view ahead.
Slow,
I whispered, and the suit obeyed, dropping me back down to a walking pace drift. A faint glow projected around the curve in the shaft, becoming brighter as we approached. I wondered for a moment if it was some outside light leaking in, but as the brightness increased, so I realized that its green-yellow hue owed nothing to Epsilon Eridani or any of its worlds. No stars or planets had that sickly pallor. A voice crackled into my helmet.
Speak to me, stranger.
It was not Glass. The voice was deep, slow and masculine. It seemed to come from everywhere at once. If the voice of God had announced itself into my skull, I do not think it would have been too different. Who are you?
I think I asked first.
It was not just the voice. There was something behind it, a sort of chorus of other voices, repeating a refrain. I tried to pick out the words, but their meaning was just out of reach. I was hearing one of the older languages, predating the modern forms of Norte, Canadian, or Russish. There was still only vacuum around us, so the voice and its chorus must have been finding a way into the suit via its own communications channels. I saw no reason not to answer it truthfully. I am Miguel de Reiter. My answer seemed to amuse the voice.
De Reiter. Interesting etymology. The rider, or perhaps even the knight. Into the haunted castle you ride. What business brings you to me, Miguel de Reiter?
I wish I knew. But guessing that this answer might not satisfy my nameless host, I added, I'm here under duress, and I don't even know for certain where here is.
Yet you presume upon an invitation to continue. Are you a captain, Delighter? I've met all the captains. I think I was a captain once.
I spread my arms and legs and made faint, slipping contact with the sides of the walls. The suit had been drifting, so it only took a little effort to bring myself to a halt. I'm not a captain, but I have come from a ship, and the person who operates it is missing. Her name is Glass, and my suit is telling me she's somewhere inside this ship.
Is Glass your friend?
No, I answered carefully. I think it would be safe to say she's anything but a friend. The voice deliberated. There would have been silence if it had not been for that underlying chorus, still continuing. Now my brain picked out the meaning from the words. English, pre-trans-enlightenment. Words I understood with effort.
Tell me, who's that writing, John the Revelator? Tell me, who's that writing, John the Revelator? John the Revelator wrote the Book of the Seven Seals.
The voice said,
You have answered well, the writer. Pray continue. In fact, I insist upon it. While you're on your way, though, tell me what it is Glass wants with you.
As I listened to the voice, I used my fingers and toes to propel myself at a slow drift, hardly faster than a walking pace. I know only what she's told me. I've been enlisted to help her find something.
Something.
She's been vague about what it is and where we'll find it. But supposedly it's something we could use against the wolves.
A weapon.
I believe so.
I've seen a lot of weapons that were meant to stop the wolves. Carried some inside me for a while. Exordium devices, hypometric weapons. None of them made a difference.
I don't know about those things. I don't even know if I believe anything that Glass has told me. But if I thought there was even a tiny chance of her being right, I'd fight to the last drop of blood.
I like your spirit.
I hope it's more than spirit.
There was a man inside me once, an old soldier. He wouldn't have stopped looking either. He'd have fought to the last drop as well. But it didn't help him in the end.
What happened?
He gave his life so that another might live. Is that a sacrifice you think you could make?
I know it for a fact.
Not many can say that. Very few, indeed, can say it and make me believe them. But with you, there's no pride or boastfulness about it. It's just a matter of fact. You've been tested and you were ready. But I'm guessing the universe played a little trick on you.
I lived, but it wasn't the universe.
Glass. Well, that wouldn't surprise me. She has a habit of twisting the fates of others. I'll come clean. We do have a little history, Glass and I. Not a long one. But enough to understand each other.
Have you killed her?
Would you like that?
I might, in the long run, but she's not much use to me dead. I've come to the conclusion that I need her to operate her ship, or to at least give me control of it. Then I get to turn around and go home to the family she ripped me away from, if either of them are still alive. I paused. Has Glass done something to you as well?
Yes. The worst thing of all, she made me live again.
I'm not sure I understand.
You will, in a moment. Come nearer, Sir Knight.
Tell me, who's that writing, John the Revelator? Tell me, who's that writing, John the Revelator? John the Revelator wrote the Book of the Seven Seals.
A rupture in the wall of the shaft was the source of the yellow-green light. I slipped through this ragged, puckered opening into a room filled with the living dead. It was a spherical chamber about 1/100th the volume of the docking bay. Jumbled around the walls of this chamber was a haphazard mosaic of reef-asleep caskets.
They were set at odd angles and alignments, and no two caskets were even approximately the same design. There were at least 50 of them, perhaps 100, and all were old. They were pressed back into the wall's fabric like stones wedged into soft cement, half interred. Each was wreathed in the same branching, fibrous structures that I had seen in the docking bay. Some of the caskets were closed, with no easy clue as to who or what might be inside them. Some were open and empty, their lids hinged wide as crocodile jaws. Others were open but still occupied. Bodies rested inside, in various states of corruption or decay. The yellow-green light emanated from the flesh of these bodies, from the caskets in which they lay, from the vine-like growths enshrouding them. They were dead, all of the bodies that were exposed to vacuum, but some were still moving. Their heads shifted at my approach. Their mouths were working, jaws opening and closing in time to the words of the chorus.
Tell me who's that writing, John the Revelator. Tell me who's that writing, John the Revelator. John the Revelator wrote the Book of the Seven Seals.
The horror of this chorus of the dead nearly overcame me. The only thing that moored my sanity, anchoring me to the moment, was the presence of Glass. I had come for Glass. Glass was still alive. Everything else was madness, but if I could hold on to that.
Tell me who's that writing, John the Revelator.
Her suit was being pinned down on a plinth, formed from another casket, set on top of a second. About a dozen bodies were ranged around this plinth, each with at least a hand pressed against Glass, holding her in place. They were singing, opening their jaws to vacuum. The bodies used their other limbs to lock themselves together and, in turn, to apply leverage against the other caskets to hold her in place. Glass writhed under their pressure. She thrashed her limbs a little, but even the augmentation of her suit was insufficient to overcome that deadening laying on of hands.
"Can you hear me?" I asked.
"Tirita," she said, suddenly and breathlessly. "Get out of here. Go back to Scythe, and tell it to initiate."
"Now, now, Glass," said the voice. "Is that how you mean to reward me, after all I've done, by having your clever little ship gut me from inside?"
"Who are you?" I asked, fighting every natural instinct to turn and flee this place of horror. "What is your connection to Glass?"
"Tell him," the voice said. "Tell him everything."
"You'll kill me whatever I do or say."
"Just answer him," I said. Glass fought the hands, but with dwindling conviction. I wondered how long she had been here, how weakened she had become. Then some acceptance must have come over her. I heard the faintest of sighs before she began.
"I needed a ship."
"You had one."
"I needed a second ship."
"You have one," I said.
"Let me explain."
I looked around at the ghoulish spectacle. I would have been frozen with shock and revulsion, except for the tiny suspicion that my host had marked me as an ally, or at least an enemy of Glass.
"Go ahead," I said.
"Now's as good a time as ever."
"I'd been looking for you for a long time. First I went to Ararat, but you weren't there. But you left a lead, a hint as to where I'd find you.
Michaelmas, except that world had no name until you landed on it, and I couldn't go to Michaelmas directly. The work ahead of me was too great. I needed allies, individuals who could attack one part of the problem while I worked on another."
"This is not starting to make sense." "Give her time," the voice said teasingly. "It's the truth, isn't it, Glass? However outlandish. John the Revelator wrote the Book of the Seven Seals."
Her helmet nodded. The hands permitted her that much movement.
"We agreed to travel separately. Me to AU Microscopy, my allies to Epsilon Eridani, for which they needed a ship of their own. Fortunately, they had one, though it was a little damaged."
"This is the ship they came in," I asked.
"We're in the Epsilon Eridani system?" The voice laughed.
"I am the ship. But she lies. I wasn't damaged. I was dead."
"Who are you?"
"I've had many names.
Before I died, I chose a last one for myself. Now they sing my praises.
Then your name is John. I hesitated, wondering how close I might be to giving lethal offence. You were, some kind of construct, a gamma level or above, tasked to run this ship?
Not a construct, a man,
just like you.
There was a man, a captain,
Glass said.
He had been old and strange long before the plague ever touched him. Gradually, he seeped into the structure of the ship, became inseparable from it. When I had Scythe inject the remains of this ship with plague-resistant replicator packages, it wasn't the plague that fought back. It was the ship, fighting my attempts to bring it back to life. It was John the Revelator.
They warned you I'd be trouble.
You think I was ready to abandon my plans at the say-so of a barely sentient pig?
A better pig than you'll ever know.
Glass scoffed. I wondered, given her circumstances, if that was the wisest course of action.
I went in with heavier measures, forced the ship into accepting my treatment. I won. I turned the ship to my will, made it capable of one or two final interstellar hops, and sent my associates to Yellowstone.
You tortured me back to life.
I gave you another chance to redeem yourself.
Please, I said, raising a hand. Whatever grievances there are between you, I'm not a part of them, but I do need Glass. Please let her go.
I could take her apart, piece by piece before your eyes. Perhaps you think she is strong. Would you like to see how very much stronger I am? Would you like to see the things I could do to her?
I want her alive. She turned my colony against itself, paralyzed our defenses, and threatened us with decompression. Thanks to Glass, there's very little chance that I'll ever see my wife again, or her daughter.
Their names, Miguel de Reiter.
I swallowed on my answer. Nicola. And Victorine.
Good names. Did you love them?
With all my heart.
I believe you. We are both old men, and we have a sense of these things. But I wonder even more why you do not want her dead.
Glass can go to hell, but only Glass knows how to work her ship.
I could kill her, and then work my way into her ship. I don't think it would be too hard for me to unravel its secrets. There's not much I don't know about ships. It helps being one.
Even if you could do that.
He couldn't,
Glass interrupted. Scythe would destroy him from the inside the moment he tried to breach its defenses. He is not stronger. He just caught me at an inopportune moment. My defense is not at optimum readiness.
Put that on your gravestone, Glass.
There's something else, I said, admitting it to myself as I said it. Now that I've been dragged here against my will, I at least want the satisfaction of knowing there was a point to it. I want to meet these associates, the ones you carried with you. What was their business in Yellowstone? Our last report said the wolves had left only ruins, in orbit and down on the surface. I'd also like to know more about Charybdis and what it has to do with killing wolves. If that means keeping Glass alive a little longer, so be it.
She doesn't know what became of her two associates.
Do you?
They left. They went off in a smaller ship I carried inside me to this system.
When?
I don't remember. I've stopped keeping track of time.
You would have to.
Maybe it was 10 years ago. Maybe it was 10 weeks.
I directed my next question at Glass. What happened to the planned rendezvous? How long have we been here before I woke up?
I don't know what happened, only that they're not here.
Glass paused.
Scythe docked 3 weeks ago.
My associates were supposed to have reached Yellowstone in a smaller vehicle, completed their operation in Chasm City, and made it back here to the Light Hugger ahead of us.
They should have been done years ago. They had ample time, decades to spare. The plan was that they'd seal up and go into reefer sleep until I arrived. When I couldn't find them, I went looking for my inertial clock.
Your what?
A device I left aboard, in case I needed to reconstruct its movements. My suit homed in on it. It led me here.
Is she telling the truth, John? The ship gave a dry laugh. For once.
These two associates, do you hate them as much as you hate glass?
No,
he said after a moment's reflection. I could never hate them. But it sounds as if they were co-conspirators in whatever Glass did to you.
They never realized how far she was prepared to go in forcing my resurrection. If they turned a blind eye, allowed themselves to be persuaded against their better judgment, there have been worse crimes. I should know. I committed some of them.
Do you know where they are?
They never came back to me after they left. The last indication I had from them put them in the vicinity of Yellowstone, but I can't even say whether they made it into the atmosphere, let alone to Chasm City.
What was their business there?
Ask Glass.
Please, let her come back with me. You don't have to forgive her for what she's done. Just let me be the one who eventually punishes her.
Forgive me, Sir Knight. But you don't seem to be in much of a position to be punishing anyone. From what you've said, you're her prisoner.
I'll make her pay. Not here, not now, but eventually. I stopped myself, worried that I might be making an awful error in appealing to his better nature. The ones who never came back, were they friends of yours?
Close acquaintances, certainly. We'd been through a lot together.
Then I'll make you a pledge. Give me Glass, and we'll find out what happened to your friends.
Are you serious about this promise?
I am.
We have something in common, Sir Knight. Both of us were dragged here against our will. Both of us would like to think there was some point to our being here. Go. And let Glass take you onwards in her ship. I won't be so ungracious a host as to prevent your leaving.
Thank you.
Farewell, the writer. If we never meet again, and I rather think we won't, I'm not sorry our paths crossed today. Oh, and Glass.
Her answer came warily.
Yes? Two things. One is that the ends very rarely justify the means. You've made yourself into an instrument for serving one good end. But along the way, you've done many evil things. Reflect on those deeds.
Her voice contained a steely indifference.
And the other thing? I wouldn't want you to leave without your little toy.
One of the zombie passengers jerked upright in their casket, spasming out a stiff-jointed limb, the fingers opening to fling away a dark, grenade-sized object. Glass caught it and pressed it tight to her chest. Chapter 8. We travelled back to Scythe, retracing the path my suit had taken through the corpse of the starship, then back across the void of the docking bay to the waiting shadow of her ship.
What was that thing?
Glass was still holding John the Revelator's parting gift.
My inertial clock.
I hope it was worth the trouble. Did he really hold you there for 3 weeks?
It was nothing,
Glass dismissed. My suit could have kept me alive for years if necessary, and he was powerless to hurt me. Nothing in the universe can hurt me, unless I choose to allow it. Kill me, yes, but not hurt me. And I'd have got out eventually, once my suit had diagnosed his weaknesses and formulated countermeasures for those zombies.
What were they?
The last few passengers that he couldn't save around Hela. The little ice moon around 107 Pishum, where I first found him, plus a few bodies still left lying around. He pushed his tendrils into them, made their corpses dance like puppets.
I'm sure your suit would have found a countermeasure sooner or later. Otherwise it would have been very, very stupid to allow yourself to be trapped like that, especially after you went in alone.
It was not your concern.
Still, it became my concern, didn't it? After a silence, Glass said,
Your intervention may have accelerated the inevitable. In that regard, it was not unwelcome.
At least you had the sense to set some wake-up condition in my casket. It would have been very bad for both of us if I'd stayed asleep. I'd be stuck in Scythe, and you'd be stuck in that room.
Until my suit got me out.
Of course, I said, humouring her. Until your suit got you out, which was only ever a matter of time. Answer me truthfully, though. Are your associates really late for the party?
There is no party.
We sailed on across the void for a few more seconds, until Glass added,
They should have returned. They had an in-system vehicle, with anti-wolf augmentations. A small ship that came all the way from Hela, in the belly of John the Revelator. Not as capable as Scythe, but adequate for the purposes of their mission. It should have let them get to Yellowstone, and then into the cover of the atmosphere.
Something went wrong then. They're dead.
Or delayed. I'll have a better idea when I read out the inertial clock, if he didn't scramble it.
At some command from Glass, Scythe opened its airlock, ready to admit us back inside. I had the strangest reaction to that door. I welcomed it and wanted to be within its shelter. I despised what she had done to me and saw her ship as a silent partner in that crime. But being inside the sanctuary of Scythe was infinitely preferable to being outside it, in the plague-ridden bowels of John the Revelator. We cycled through the lock and stepped out of our suits. I was hardly fresh after the couple of hours I had spent in mine. If her story was true, Glass had been inside hers for the better part of 3 weeks. She stretched like a cat and arched her neck back, taking her first deep breath of shipborne air. A musty tang of sweat, fear and forced confinement reached me. For a second, I nearly pitied her. There was still something human beneath that white armor. We take the ship to Yellowstone, I said.
Right answer.
And I'll cooperate in any attempt to find your associates. For the purposes of that operation alone, I won't attempt to harm you or sabotage you or the ship in any way. I'll give it my all and offer any insight I think may be advantageous.
Presumably this is a temporary detente?
Until we know what happened. But my cooperation comes with terms.
Oh, terms.
She put on a look of intrigued amusement, as if I were a child who had come out with a big-sounding word.
And what would they be?
Some candor, to begin with. Before I went into reefer sleep, I think you did something to me.
Did something?
I had the strangest dreams. She creased her lips in false sympathy.
Strange dreams come with the territory. All those poor little synapses, shutting down, then lighting up again as you come out of the cold.
These were coherent. Something about a war on Mars. Glass nodded sagely.
Well then, we're getting somewhere. You want candor, Doreyta? I'll give you candor. But you won't thank me for it.
John the Revelator let us leave. A huge circular door opened in the end of the docking chamber, pivoting on a single massive hinge, and Scythe slipped out into empty space. From the vantage point of the control room, where I sat in the seat to the left of Glass, I had my first view of both the system into which we had arrived and the ship where Glass's rendezvous had failed. The latter was as large as any lighthugger, but I saw only disconnected elements of its whole, glimpses that I was forced to assemble in my imagination, much as if I were a traveller catching hints of some forbidding, mist-wreathed castle atop a craggy pinnacle. The ship was as dark as the space around it, and gave off no illumination of its own. Nor did Scythe throw any light against it as we departed. Glass was very careful in that regard. All that served to define the broken pieces of the starship's form was the light from Epsilon Eridani, and since we were at 20 AU, 400 light-minutes away, the star offered only a dim, ember-like illumination, picking out certain details in faint, dusky reds and browns,
and throwing only a deeper funereal pall over the rest of it. All lighthuggers had a dagger-like form, the better to carve their way through the resistance of interstellar space. But this ship was a dagger that had been rusted and mangled nearly to uselessness. The hull had been ripped away in vast areas, revealing a sort of anatomy lesson on the internal structure of starships. The front part, the stabbing point of the blade, was nearly intact. But halfway to the hilt, the ship withered in on itself, as if an iron-gloved fist had closed around the blade and shattered most of it away. The elements that formed the hilt, the outriggers for the conjoiner drive, were ragged, woodwormed, see-through in places. Stars glimmered through a gristle of ship-sized bones, tendons, and nerves. But the outriggers had done their work, I saw. The engines were still in place, even if they showed great and possibly crippling levels of damage. "Would the wolves know that this ship is here?" I asked.
"By now? Almost certainly. But it came in quietly after crossing space from Hela, and from any sort of distance it looks like any other drifting lifeless wreck. It's of no concern to them now. It poses no threat, and there's nothing left of our technology that they have the slightest interest in."
"Is John the Revelator a man stuck inside that ship, or the ship itself?"
"Do you think it matters?"
"Whichever it is, I think it matters that you made him live against his will."
"I needed a ship,"
Glass answered. Then, nearly under her breath,
"John the Revelator suited my purposes. The universe owed him no mercy, Miguel, no clemency or kindness. If I started accounting the bad deeds of his life to you now, we'd be here until the wolves are danced. But that doesn't mean I set out to be intentionally cruel. If there had been another way, or another chance, I might have done things differently."
The console chimed. It had completed its retrieval of the embedded data in the inertial clock. Numbers and curves sprung onto the displays. Glass stared at them in icy silence.
"Well," I prompted, "this isn't right. They've taken too long."
"We already knew that."
"To get here in the first place," she said, irritated. "The clock says they've taken much longer to reach this system than I expected."
"So much for expectations."
"Something happened to delay them,"
she said, muttering to herself. "How bad is it?" Glass breathed in heavily.
"I zeroed the inertial clock when I left them on Hela in 7:50, on my way to you. By then I'd set the repair processes in motion, so I didn't need to oversee them until completion. I knew the condition of the lighthugger, what needed to be done to make it spaceworthy. John the Revelator resisted me initially, but I knew that he would see the ultimate righteousness of my cause and accept his place in my plans. Together with his passengers, they should have been underway in a year, 2 years, but the clock is flat for another 20 years.
"What does that mean?" Half annoyed by my question, half keen to show off the cleverness of her gadget, Glass directed my attention to a line which started at a low value and moved to the right, staying horizontal for 20 tick marks.
"The clock records local acceleration. That's all it can measure while being inside the lighthugger. After I left them, it holds at a steady 1/4 of a G. That's them sitting in the local gravity field of Hela, not going anywhere. It spikes here after 20 years. That must be the launch event, when the lighthugger boosted itself back into space. Then it drops to 0 for a few weeks, engine checkout and final repairs in weightlessness, before it then ramps up to 1G for the interstellar hop between 107 Piscium and Epsilon Eridani."
"So they took 20 years to fix up the ship, instead of a year or two." "That doesn't seem unreasonable to me. Plans rarely go to schedule."
"Based on your vast expertise of ship repairs?"
"I haven't repaired a ship," I admitted, "but I did dismantle one. It took us 5 years to strip the Salmasis down for useful supplies. After we landed on Michaelmas, we'd expected it to take a year, 18 months at the longest. Plans do that." Glass brooded, not quite able to dismiss my point.
"They still took too long, even allowing for those 20 years. Look at this."
She jabbed her finger at the diagonally rising line of the 1G profile. The clock is in the same inertial frame as the ship, so it should record one gravity all the way up to the midpoint. But something happens after a couple of months.
The acceleration doesn't hold. It drops down to about half a G, then never recovers. Engine trouble, presumably. Either the sea drives couldn't keep operating at the desired output, the shielding was worn out, or the rest of the ship couldn't tolerate the stresses. So they throttled back, reduced the acceleration to a rate that was sustainable. I shrugged. Half a G will still get you to relativistic speed. It'll just take longer to get there. But that's not really a problem if you're crossing tens of light years. You'd only be adding a year or two onto a trip that was already going to take decades.
But they never get above 75% of the speed of light.
Glass's finger hovered over a part of the trace that was flat and zero until the line dipped into negative acceleration.
They cruise most of the way, engines at idle, until the slowdown. A crossing that should have taken 20 years takes 30.
So allowing for the delay before departure, that puts them about 30 years behind schedule. Glass thought to herself.
They should still have had time. Our differing trajectories allowed for a significant margin of delay. Even with the delay, the light huggers still been sitting in this system for 28 years. Enough time for them to take the in-system ship to Yellowstone and back many times over. Something else must have gone wrong.
Can you see how long ago they left?
No, only the movements of the main ship. Their departure wouldn't have created a big enough event to register on the clock.
So they could have left 28 years ago, or 28 days. You have no idea which, and John the Revelator can't be trusted to be any help either. This plan is going really well, isn't it? Glass seethed.
The plan is still viable. If they didn't manage to return to the rendezvous point, that doesn't preclude them or someone else still being in possession of the items I need. Can you tolerate 3 Gs? Or do I need to put you back into reefer sleep?
Whatever you can tolerate, I can tolerate. Glass smiled at my naivety. Even as her plans came apart, it was good to see that she could still take some pleasure in my shortcomings.
It's tragic. You aren't even close to understanding how wrong you are.
Glass could move around unassisted in 3 Gs, but it was too exhausting for me. After watching my groaning, stumbling efforts, as if she was running a book on how long it would take me to break a bone, she had the ship produce a wiry, insubstantial-looking exoskeletal frame, which could be worn over or under my clothing. It was surprisingly effective, and clever enough to be able to apply its support without inducing pressure points that would soon turn to sores. It even had a padded rest for my skull, cupping under my jaw and the back of my head to alleviate the load on my spine and neck muscles. I took a few minutes to adjust to the frame, and then stopped noticing it was there. The frame was already learning my gait and gestures, anticipating my movements like a dance partner. Scythe's acceleration was still arduous. My blood weighed 3 times as much as normal, so my heart had more work to do. But with the frame easing the load on my bones, muscles, and ligaments, and with no risk of injuring myself, the frame wouldn't allow me to trip or otherwise come to harm. I could at least move around and take care of personal hygiene without undue difficulty. Glass insisted that we continue to take our meals in the dining room, with food cooked and served by the onboard robots. Once I had adjusted to the heavy feeling of the cutlery in my hands, the way the wine jumped from the bottle to the glass, and the way the slimmest goblet felt like a tankard, it was surprisingly normal. Surprisingly normal and almost, almost convivial.
A confession,
Glass said, putting a piece of bread on my plate.
The support unit is only temporary. Over time, it will reduce its augmentation level.
If you want to see me suffer, there are quicker ways to go about it.
You won't suffer. You'll need the unit less and less, because you'll be getting stronger. While you were under, I had the casket undertake some nanotherapeutic repairs. They're still playing out. Hard to move cells around when they're frozen. But as the days pass, you'll start to feel the effects. Those old bones of yours are no use to me. I'm rebuilding them, stripping away the years. Nothing magical, Just a suite of rejuvenation methods that we wouldn't have batted an eyelid at 3 centuries ago. It'll ache a little while they make themselves strong again, but that will be a good sort of pain. There are machines inside me now. There you are, being a warrior again. Let me put your mind at ease. The odds of any plague spore touching you are tiny, and I wouldn't even take that chance, unless my medicines were already impervious. She lifted her goblet, unaugmented, not even a trace of a tremble in her hands. Which they are. What are you trying to turn me into? Not turn you into something. Turn you back into what you used to be. I was never anything. And yet this man, who was never anything, somehow ended up running a community of 5,000 people and holding them together through thick and thin for 30 years. Someone had to do it. Once upon a time, Glass said, eyeing me through the red filter of her wine, you were a soldier. I think I'd remember. No, not after you took steps to blockade and scramble your own memories. Glass laced her fingers, looking at me with a seriousness of expression that was all the more unnerving because I felt it to be sincere. You were one of 2 brothers, both destined for military service. Your brother was an important man, born a long time ago. His name was Neville Clavaine, and he was a soldier also. More than a soldier. A high-ranking military asset during the First Conjoiner War. He was on the side of the Coalition for Neural Purity, an organization opposed to the Conjoiner experiments on Mars. But something happened to Neville Clavaine. He was captured by the Conjoiners, and later released. Unharmed and untouched. The experience drove a wedge into his loyalty to the Coalition. Later, he defected wholesale to the other side. Thereafter, he was closely aligned with the Conjoiners, without ever fully committing to their ethos. The perpetual outsider, doomed to never feel entirely at home. No, I said angrily. I've nothing to do with that man, that monster. And then I thought, I have been having a strange dream of Mars, of a war from the wrong end of history. Glass said mildly, let me continue. Please do, I said, with a sudden defeated sense. I might as well hear it to the bitter end. Clavaine's life spans centuries. In his later years, he became involved in the early effort against the Wolves. There was a factional struggle within the Conjoiners. Differences of opinion over strategy, squabbles over forbidden weapons, and dangerous experiments. At some point, Clavaine lost his life. That was unfortunate, because I believe him to have had strategic and tactical insights that could help us, including one very important piece of information. And you think I have it? Actually, I'm as sure as I can be that you don't. I raised my glass and drank to the futility of her mission. Then I'm sorry you've wasted all these years. Nothing's been wasted. Glass stopped while the robots bustled in with food, all of it predictably appetizing. She watched as they set out the meal, smiling slightly, and no doubt sparing part of that smile for my discomfort. Because of the manner and location of Clavaine's death, there's a chance that the mission-critical information is still retrievable. Charybdis. I tried to retrieve it myself and failed, but the odds would be better if someone with a blood connection to Neville tried. Even if some parts of this were true, I'm no use to you. I'm not the man you think you've found.
On the contrary, Warren, you are exactly the man.
Who is Warren?
You are, Glass said. That's your real name. Warren Clavaine. You were one of the elite strategists in the Coalition for Neural Purity. A thinker and a warrior in the same cold package. You had a name for yourselves, you and your little gang of super soldiers, suitably self-aggrandizing.
A nervousness stirred in me as I asked, which was?
The Knights of Cydonia.
Glass made an encouraging gesture towards the meal, even as the last certain part of myself collapsed into immense, sucking hollowness.
Tuck in, Sir Knight. We've work ahead of us.
When I returned to my room aboard Scythe, I found something new in there. It was resting on the bedside table, secured against sudden shifts in local gravity by a friction pad. It was an ornament of sorts, and heavy as a bludgeon when I lifted it in my hand. A thick wooden base sprouted an upright metal rod, which, in turn, formed the support for a chunk of rough, semi-translucent material. I fingered the material. It was a crudely finished rectangle, about 20 centimeters from side to side, a little wider than it was tall. It was buckled along two gentle curves, side to side and top to bottom, as if what the rod supported was only a section, cut from a larger, approximately spherical form. The material was about half as thick as my little finger, and ragged around the edges. The surface was pitted and scoured to the point where I could make out an impression of shapes and colours through it, but nothing sharp. Notably, there was a small hole in the middle of the material. It went all the way through it, and radiated a fine network of cracks. I rolled the ornament in my hands, certain of two things: that it meant something to me, that I had seen it before in some context, and that nothing about its appearance here was accidental. Glass had left it deliberately, in the sure knowledge that I would find it troubling. The ornament drew something from my lips, unbidden. "Faith," I whispered, "and hope." Then, finally, "and charity." In a fit of rage and denial, I slammed the ornament down against the table, but no part of it